We're living in an era of information overload. We've more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but for getting inspired. Notion is the AI-powered workspace where the everyday takes care of itself. Meetings have summaries, docs find themselves, and every question has an answer. Because Notion AI turns knowledge into action, and I know that myself because I once asked it to write an introduction for a How to Fail episode, and I have to say, it was so helpful and so convincing. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/fail. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/fail, and start turning ideas into action. And when you use our link, you're supporting our show. Notion.com/fail. Hello, and welcome to How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, the podcast that celebrates the things that haven't gone right. This is a podcast about learning from our mistakes and understanding that why we fail ultimately makes us stronger. Because learning how to fail in life actually means learning how to succeed better. I'm your host, author and journalist Elizabeth Day, and every week I'll be asking a new interviewee what they've learned from failure. Tom Daley is only 28, but his achievements belong to that of a much older person. As a sportsman, his awards are legion. He's an Olympic gold medalist diver, a three-time world champion, and the first ever British person to win four Olympic diving medals. He started diving at the age of seven, and his talent was spotted early at the Plymouth Diving Club. By 14, he was the youngest competitor at the 2008 Summer Olympics. Away from the diving platform, Daley's life has been one of growth and personal challenge. He was bullied at school and had periods of severe anxiety. His beloved father, Rob, died of cancer at the age of 40, a few days after Daley's 17th birthday. In 2013, Daley made what he called a huge decision to release a YouTube video talking about his sexuality and his loving relationship with a man. He was one of the most high-profile athletes to do so, and the impact was seismic. Daley is now a powerful LGBTQ+ advocate. He's married to American screenwriter Dustin Lance Black, and the couple have a four-year-old son. And of course, there's the knitting. Having been spotted knitting in between dives at the Tokyo Games, Daley rapidly became a craft influencer and launched his own range of knit patterns called Made with Love. There's now an accompanying book. According to the UK Hand Knitting Association, Daley is responsible for a surge of men interested in the hobby. But more on that later. A knitter, an Olympic diver, a TV personality, a father, and a fashion icon. Given all of this, it's perhaps no surprise that in his autobiography, Coming Up for Air, Daley writes that the path to success is never linear. Tom Daley, welcome to How to Fail.
Hello. What an introduction. Oh my gosh.
Well, I should actually say welcome back to How to Fail, because although we've never recorded our conversations before, this is the third time that I've had the joy of talking to you. And I'm so glad that we can make this happen. And I'm glad you also liked your introduction, because for me, writing it made me realise that you are someone I really admire because you are unafraid to pursue your passions. Like the knitting, yes. The diving, the fashion. Has that always been the case?
For as long as I can remember, if I set my sights on something or I want to achieve something, I'm all in. I go for it. There's nothing that's ever going to hold me back, and I will do everything that I can to get there. And you know, it's been a road that's not always easy, as you know. And I think I've gotten to a point in my life now in particular where I just don't care what anyone else thinks. I want to like just follow my heart, follow my passions, and do, as long as I know I'm being the best person that I can be for the planet and for the people around me, then I'm doing all right.
We all appreciate your joyous presence. And that thing about not caring what people think is so valuable. And
at 28, like, you've nailed that. It's taken me a really long time. I'm still not there. I still care what people think. What do you think it was that has brought you to that point? Do you think it's just living life in public? It makes you have to not care.
I think there's a number of things. Like, I think I first did anything in terms of TV, like documentary or anything like that, when I was about 9 or 10 years old. So I have kind of had to live my life very much in the public eye, had to go through, you know, bullying, through changing schools, going to the Olympics and figuring out my sexuality, all of that, and losing my dad in a very, very public way, which was like really quite challenging and quite daunting. And it got to a point where I was so worried about what everyone else was thinking, and especially with the age of social media. And honestly, as I got older, in particular when I lost my dad, and then after the Olympics in London, I was so excited about competing at these games. But at the same time, I tortured myself through the whole experience because I wanted to do so well and I didn't want to mess up. And I also just found myself, as I was getting older, only defining myself as a person based on how well I was diving. Mm. So again, that wasn't something that was particularly healthy. But I do think becoming a parent changed my perspective on that completely. Like, you realize what matters most. And I also think the pandemic, essentially, and having all of those lockdowns made me appreciate the fact that things can change at any moment. You never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You never know what's going to happen in the next few minutes. And to try and live as presently and treasure and be so grateful for what you have in the here and now, because you never know when it's going to change or be taken away or be messed up in some sort of way.
I just want to take a moment to pay tribute to your dad and thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm so sorry for your loss. And you mentioned your own fatherhood there. And I know your son is called Robbie. Your dad was called Rob. Yes. Has it been healing becoming a father yourself? Has it been healing for your grief?
When you become a parent, I think the first thing that you realize is like, oh my gosh, how much your parents did for you when you were growing up. Like, so like, I just think about what my mum and dad had to go through in terms of, I've got two younger brothers as well. So it wasn't just me. It was then figuring out what my brothers were doing with their school, with the clubs that they wanted to do. They were into their football and rugby. I was into my diving. And then all of the places that they had to be all at once and how much they sacrificed and gave up to do that. And I think the one thing is, I think I understand my parents a lot more now from being a parent. And some of the things that I used to find extremely embarrassing about my dad, I now get it. Like, without knowing, I guess, he taught me so many lessons, like in particular about not caring what other people think, because he was like a complete goofball when it came to like trying to make people laugh and making jokes and all of that. And I just used to get so embarrassed by it. But now I'm like, oh, what? He just didn't worry so much about what other people were thinking of him.
Yeah. Now, you obviously started young and you're still incredibly young. And it did lead to some quite astonishing life moments at a very, very precocious age. Is it true, Tom Daly, that you persuaded Kate Moss to pose for a recreation of an original portrait by David Hockney as part of your GCSE photography project?
So it's kind of even more wild of a story than that, honestly. I was doing GCSE photography and I had studied David Hockney for one of my pieces. And then I had a photo shoot coming up with Italian Vogue with Kate Moss in a swimming pool. So there's me and Kate Moss in a swimming pool being shot by Bruce Weber. And then afterwards, I just, you know, I thought, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I just was like, would you mind if I just like took a couple of pictures of you for my GCSE photography? And then Bruce like saw me taking photos of Kate and then was like, oh no, come over here and do. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like, what is going on? Like, and I mean, I got 100% in my GCSE photography.
I'm sure.
And then later with the David Hockney thing, I met him in LA one time and he was like, oh, one day I should paint you or I should draw you or do something. And then I was over there on mine and Lance's honeymoon and got an email from David Hockney studio. I was like, well, I see you're in LA. Do you want to come in tomorrow? And he drew me and he drew me nude, this first nude since 1960. And it was like such a like a crazy, yeah. Wow. So it was very, very surreal moments. Yeah.
Where is that portrait now?
So it was hanging in the LA County Museum. So I don't actually know where the original portrait is, but I've got a couple hanging up in Lance's office of like the studio prints of it. And I'm just like, it's so random. But yeah, like one of the things Lance said, it was funny. It's like he left me in David's studio and was like, okay, I'll see you in a few hours. I'll be back. And Lance walks in. The first thing he sees is the easel with David sat at it drawing, and he sees my underwear hanging off of the easel. And like, so it was quite an extraordinary story, to be honest.
How incredible. You mentioned casually there that you got 100% in your GCSE photography, and I happen to know that you are a straight A student, A's across the board, at the same time as you were diving at a world championship level. That must have been a lot of stress at a young age, plus the fact, as you mentioned, that you were bullied at school. How did you cope during those years?
I had to go from a very young age that we're in the public eye with lots of different things. Going to the Olympics, I qualified at 13. And what happened was, over the summer when I went to Beijing for the Olympics, I came back thinking, you know, I was just going to go back to school like normal. And things so dramatically changed in the way that people treated me in terms of the older kids versus the younger kids. And it came a place that I never wanted to go. And it got to the point where I was like being hurt at school and things like that. And I just got to a point where I was like, I can't do that anymore. And I was like, I'm either going to have to be homeschooled or move. And so I moved schools, and it was 10 days before the first set of like GCSEs, like when they do them in year 10 for some science ones. And I basically had to learn the whole new curriculum in 10 days because it was a different exam board. For English, for example, we had to choose which poems we were going to learn out of the 10 based on ones that had already come up in previous years, because I didn't have time to learn all of them. So it was, yeah, extremely stressful in that time. And then I had to get, for when it got to GCSEs and A-levels, I was doing my A-levels the year of London 2012. So I did London 2012, and then I had to go back in the September afterwards to go and finish my A-levels. So yeah, it was a... Wow. I think it was a good distraction away from the sport as well, which now is what knitting provides for me, I guess.
Did you ever want to give diving up at those moments when you were being physically assaulted at your school and you having to learn GCSE syllabi in 10 days? Yeah. Did you ever want to give it up?
Yeah. I mean, there's been many times where I've wanted to give up diving. And I think if anyone says to you that they've never thought about giving up their big passion in some moments of stress and under pressure, then they're probably lying to you. You know, you always have those thoughts. But when you have those days that you just show up and you keep going, that kind of really make the biggest difference. I also do find that one of my biggest times and one of my biggest periods of when I wanted to give up was after London 2012, because when I was 9 years old, I drew a picture of myself doing a handstand that had the Olympic rings and said London 2012. And at 9 years old, when I drew that, that was my end goal. That was like, I want to go to the London 2012 Olympic Games. So when I got there, I'd won my medal in front of a home crowd. It didn't get any better than that. And I was so, so happy. And then, you know, 10 days later, I was back to training, back to school, getting ready for the next thing. And I kind of felt like I lost my purpose. I was like, what do I do now? Where do I go? How am I going to move on to the next thing? What is going to be my next thing? I've got to wait 4 years now before another Olympics. And I found myself in a really dark place of like, well, I mean, people call it post-Olympic blues, but I couldn't really speak to anyone about it because I was, you know, I'd won an Olympic medal. So if I spoke to any of my teammates, they were like, oh, well, you've already won an Olympic medal. Like, what have we got to be sad about? And it got to a point where I was so unhappy with everything that I actually decided to quit. And I went to LA to do some stuff for like Nickelodeon for their like Kids' Choice Awards or something like that. And that was on the trip that I met Lance for the first time. And meeting him and understanding what he has done in his career, he had a similar feeling as me with the down that comes after a high, after he won an Oscar in 2009, to then coming down off the back of that and what was to come next, what was the purpose. He had lost his brother in 2012. I'd lost my dad in 2011. So we had both suffered this similar things and we connected on that level. And that was actually what inspired me to get back into diving, because I was like, I'm not alone in this anymore.
That's beautiful. And Lance won an Oscar for the screenplay of Milk, an extraordinary film. And you've both been quoted in the past as saying that it was love at first sight. There was an immediate connection, wasn't there?
Yes, I think we broke every single dating rule on the planet. We met at a dinner that was organized by a mutual friend, and we just started talking about all kinds of complete small talk. The question I always get asked is, what goes on inside the Olympic Village? And and then Lance was like, oh, that would make an amazing TV show. And it was like all of this, like, very much small talk on the first day we met. And then I had to go back to the UK, obviously. He stayed in the US. And over the next 8 weeks, 9 weeks, we just talked every single day, like from the moment we woke up to the moment we went to sleep. And he came over for my birthday in May to London. And I had a birthday party. And on that night was when I told all of my friends and all of my family that were there that he was my boyfriend. But at that point, we hadn't talked about that. And so he was like, oh, okay, this is a thing. But then the next night, he asked me to be his boyfriend, and I said yes. And then the next day, he told me he loved me. And then the next date that we had, I just said straight up, I was like, do you see yourself getting married and having kids? And he was like, I guess, yeah. Like, yeah, I've always wanted kids too. And I was like, perfect. I was like, and then we named our kids. Aww. So, Robbie Ray was one of the names that we came up with on that bike ride in Cornwall that we went on for that date.
Oh, I'm so happy for you both. What a profoundly moving thing. And I just, before I get onto your failure, want to talk to you about parenthood, because I came across this quote that I could not love more about surrogacy, because I feel that a lot of people who are in cis relationships and get pregnant without issue don't understand how hard it is to go through what you and Lance went through, and indeed to go through a bit of what I'm going through. My fertility journey has not been straightforward. And you gave this quote when someone asked you if you wanted more kids, and you said, it's not quite as easy as a bottle of wine and a good time. A lot of thought has to go into it. And it's so true, because I actually think, and I don't know what you think about this, I'm interested in hearing your opinion, it probably makes you into a more thoughtful, considered parent, because you have to go through so much thinking before you get to the baby.
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, like you say, some parents are able to conceive really quickly and really easily without really thinking about it. Some people struggle for years. Some people end up giving up. And when they give up, that's when it happens. And some people have to go through all kinds of different fertility treatments and all kinds of things. And like you say, when you aren't able to have something, and obviously as two men, we weren't able to have kids naturally. Yeah, of course, it makes you really, really think, really, really consider. And it's like something that you've wanted so much for your whole life. I remember when I was 16 years old, I used to buy kids' clothes at airports because I was so excited about one day becoming a parent. And that was before I even met Lance. So it's something that I've always, always dreamed of. And honestly, Robbie is, and raising Robbie will always be the biggest achievement of my life, but like better than any Olympic medal, any world championship medal, nothing will compare to that feeling of, I dropped him off to school earlier and like I count down the minutes to when I can like pick him up again and just see him, like when I get to the school gate and he like sees me, he's just like, Papa, Papa. And he's like, he gets so excited and he runs out, and it's just like, there's no better feeling than that. And yeah, it's super sweet.
Don't answer this if you find it too personal, but I just wanted to know a bit about the experience of surrogacy, because I get the impression that you're someone who holds yourself to very high standards, and quite often that kind of person is a perfectionist and likes control. I don't know if that's ringing any bells.
Yes, I mean, I do like, yeah, yes.
I'm in that category as well.
Yeah.
What's it like handing over a pregnancy of your child to someone else?
She's our family now. Like, she is someone that we speak to nearly every single day. We FaceTime all the time. I probably speak to her more than most of my friends. She is an extremely special person, as is her family and her kids. And honestly, it's like, I never really knew what to expect going into this, but it was a magical, magical experience. And for our surrogate as well, who like has asked not to be named, but she is just so incredibly caring. And literally, she said to us after, like, that it was such a magical experience for her. She was like, if you ever want to have any more kids, it would be my honor. And I like, and she's just very, she's our guardian angel. She's the person that was able to make our dreams of having a family come true. And, you know, there's something so incredibly special about that.
Thank you so, so much, Tom. I really appreciate you opening up about that. Let's get on to your failures, because there's plenty to say about them. The first one you've chosen is Rio 2016, which you describe as the worst event ever. Tell us about that.
Rio 2016 was the Olympics right after London 2012, where for me, Beijing 2008, I was a kid, didn't really know what I was doing. It was all about experience. London 2012 was the first event where I had this expectation and this pressure to win a medal in front of a home crowd. Then I had this period of like dark times to get back into it. And then I realized once I moved to London, I had met Lance. Going into 2016, I was in the best physical condition. I was in the best mental condition of my life. And I felt like it was going to be my time to win the Olympic gold medal. For the third time of trying, I thought it was going to be my time. I had won most of the events going into it. I was feeling so confident. We won a bronze medal in the synchro with Dan Goodfellow. And then into the individual event, I went into the preliminary rounds where it's like the top 30 people. I won that event with an Olympic record. And again, going into day two of the event, we have the semifinals, and I was feeling so confident. Like I've gone to the top 18 and then the next time it's the top 12. I go into that competition, like the first dive didn't go too great. And then everything that followed started to fall apart and crumble. And no matter what I did, there was nothing that I could do that could get me back into that place that I was the night before. There were so many factors into that. I was at my leanest and not probably eating enough. My energy levels were depleted. My like nervous system probably didn't have enough fight in me to get to the final. And I completely bombed out and had the lowest score that I'd ever scored probably in about 8 years at that Olympics and came in 18th place. I was so destroyed. Like I've never felt emotion like it. Because it was so shocking and unexpected for me, for what I thought was going to happen that day. And again, always comes back to, it goes to show, like, you never know what's going to happen, no matter how well prepared you are, no matter how well you think you're doing, things can happen. And in the press conference afterwards, being like, it's not the end of me, I am going to keep fighting, I am going to keep going. And I went to my husband, who was there afterwards, out the back of the pool. I just remember like breaking down and being like, I don't know what to do. I tried everything. I sacrificed so much going into it. I didn't go out with my friends. I was in bed by 9 o'clock every day. I was making sure I was eating everything right. I literally did every single thing possible that I could do. And he just said to me, Tom, your story isn't over here. This event, this Rio 2016 will be a moment in the past. Like this is nothing for you. Your story is not finished being written. And I just said to him, I was like, what do you mean? Like, what? How am I going to come back from this? This is it. Like, I'm going to be too old at the next one. I'm never going to be able to like be at the same place that I am today. And he just said, well, maybe today wasn't meant to be. Maybe you are meant to win an Olympic gold medal in 4 years' time in front of our future child. And it was like,
Tom, stop. You know,
but it's like, it was
so beautiful.
You know, at the time, there was nothing really that was going to get me through it. And I just was like, you know what? I've got a lot to look forward to. I'm more than just a diver. And it was in that moment that I had to realize and find the fact that I'm more than just a diver. How I dive does not define me. I had a wedding to look forward to the next year. And we were going down the process of having a kid. There were so many things to look forward to. And I just, that was a real turning point in the way that I thought about diving and my life in general.
And did anyone other than Lance help you with that turning point? Or was that something that you had to do for yourself? How do you shift a perspective when you are at such a low point?
I was really lucky to have worked with an amazing sports psychologist, Kate Hayes. And I've worked with her for a very long time. And she helped me all the way through my diving career, through my ups, through my downs, through everything, as well as Lance being there as a sounding board too. And now Kate works with the Lionesses and is a psychologist for the team going into the Euros and all of that. So yeah, I was very lucky to have a lot of support there where it was like, you know what, although that was like the lowest moment in my diving career, it was a thing that turned it around. And, you know, the following year was I won the world championships and I was just like, okay, I'm back. I can do this.
I always think when I speak to athletes that we all need sports psychologists just in our daily lives. Yeah. They sound amazing. Yeah. That ability to shift your thinking to remain present is such an astonishing life skill. I want to talk to you before we get on to what happened next. I want to get into how vulnerable you must feel, because you're standing there on a diving board way up high, in front of the world's media, in front of a crowded auditorium in the swimming pool, about to do something physically so dangerous and challenging, and you're barely wearing anything. And yes. It just struck me when I was preparing this interview how unbelievably vulnerable that must make you feel.
Yeah, there's not many people that can say they wear more to bed than they do to work, but that's me. But like you say, like, you're stood up on the diving board in not very much. And I've had lots of different issues with that concept for a while. Like, before the Olympics in 2012, I was told by my performance director that I was fat and I had to lose weight. And it was the first time that I saw my body as something that wasn't just what I was using to dive, but people were looking at it to see how much body fat percentage I had. And that then caused a period of bulimia where I was really, and I found it extremely difficult every day to eat and not feel guilty about what I had eaten if I put weight on. And there was all of these things. So yes, it is a very vulnerable position to be in on that diving board. And then once you add into that all of the pressures of actually performing and all of the pressures of getting that one chance, you know, in the Olympic Games, it's once every 4 years and you've got six dives. And then you think about how many thousands of dives I do in that period of time building up to it. It's quite an intense position to be in, for sure.
Thank you so much for talking about that, because I think it's really important that we all understand that disordered eating affects all genders. And that's very courageous of you to talk about it. Where are you now with how you feel about your body?
Some days I have good days, some days I have bad days. There's also an adjustment in the fact that I haven't set foot on a diving board since the Tokyo Olympics. So there's that period of time where I'm like, you know what, like, I need to figure out what that transition might look like out of sport. Or when I go back into sport, am I going to be really hard on myself? Like, there's so many things that I have to think about every day with it. And one of the things that I always try to do is be kind to myself, be forgiving of myself if I make mistakes. Sometimes the thoughts I have that I say to myself, I'm like, would I ever say that to somebody else? And why would you treat yourself any lesser than what you might say to somebody else?
I totally agree. I always remind myself to talk to myself as I would talk to my best friend.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you're not going to say the things that you say in your head to your best mate. No. So, yeah.
Let's talk about what happened next after Rio 2016, the worst event ever, in your words. The next Olympics was 2020. Now, it sounds like your mindset had shifted in the interim, but what happened for you in 2020?
I went into 2020 with a completely different perspective. I had perspective, essentially. I went into those Olympics after 2 years of pandemic where things had changed, with the Olympics had moved. And like, the thought of the Olympics moving was so unthinkable, and being a parent. And I just went into those games and I was like, you know what? No matter what happens at these Olympics, I know that I'm going to go home to a family and friends that love me and will celebrate whatever I achieve at these Olympic Games. And again, I'm more than just a diver. I am a father, I'm a husband, I'm a friend, I'm a brother, I'm a son, a knitter. But there were so many other things that I was doing that I was just like, you know what, I'm content. And I think that was the real power of going into that competition, was I felt at peace with everything that I had done. And I remember going into that competition with Matty for the synchro. And that's the most high pressure situation, because there's only six dives. It's a straight final. There's no second chances. You have to just go into it. And if you mess up a dive, you're out and it's over and it's gone. So I just remember going through dive by dive and being able to zone out in between each dive with some knitting. I know it sounds crazy, but I do think the reason that I was able to hold it together and also keep Matty as well in that same headspace was because of knitting. Because there was so much time to overthink because of the COVID Olympics. It was, you couldn't socialise. You couldn't do anything outside the village. You had to either be eating in the dining hall and then leave right away, and then stay in your room until it was time to leave to go to training. So there was a lot of time just to sit around and worry. And I think that was what got me out of my head. And yeah, to come away with that Olympic gold medal, and that I just remember seeing the scores come up for the Chinese diver's last dive. And I was like looking in the corner of the scoreboard, and I had to see a number two to know that we were number one. And I remember just seeing that number two flash up. And I just, there was this moment of going into those Olympics where I thought I was going to have to get ready to try and be comfortable with the fact that I was never going to be an Olympic champion.
Wow.
And to have it come true was just, yeah, it was mind blowing.
Do you think almost you have to let go? It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we're told to manifest our dreams and our future. And on the other hand, we're told to let go of a goal if it's putting too much pressure on us. And it's, I suppose maybe it's finding the equilibrium, but do you think that there was something for you where you had to let go of the dream in order to achieve it?
You know, there's a couple of things. So during lockdown, we had this date night thing where either Lance or I would cook and then the other person would come up with an activity. And one of the activities that I came up with one week was to paint on canvases because we wanted to hang some things up on a wall. So I painted these canvases and with Lance one week, and like some of them were absolutely awful. So then the next week, Lance just came up with the idea. He got some gold leaf to cover up one of the paintings so that it would be by the front door every single time I left to think about an Olympic gold. But also on that canvas, we both wrote our ultimate dream in the next 5 years on that canvas. And I wrote to become Olympic champion. And it's covered. And Lance wrote, I won't say because Lance is still on that journey. But then we covered it up with gold leaf. But then we knew every time we left the house that that was there. So yeah. In a way, there was that manifesting. And I think it is important to manifest and visualize, because I did that every single day. I was visualizing a lot. But when you're there and when you're doing it and when you're in it, you have to be in it. You can't be visualizing the outcome when you're in it, because while you're in it, you have to be fully invested in the process in order for the outcome to go your way.
That's fascinating. So you can visualize as part of your preparation, and then you have to be in it. You have to be in the process. That's so interesting. Yeah. And so applicable to so many areas of life. Now, it doesn't escape my notice that you did win gold when your son was alive and there to witness it. So yes. What was Robbie's reaction? What does he think of your gold medal?
Because none of my family or friends were able to come to Tokyo because no spectators were allowed. They were in Canada. So my mum, Lance and Robbie, they were all in Canada watching online. It was the middle of the night there in Canada. I think it was like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. And they woke Robbie up to watch it. And, you know, I think he was like half asleep on the sofa. And then there's that video of the reaction to the last dive where we had won the gold, of Lance jumping up and screaming. And yeah, I think it's funny. It was actually yesterday morning was the first morning where I think Robbie started to understand what Papa does in a way, because he said to me, Papa, why is it whenever we leave the house, people want to have photos with you and not me?
Great question.
And I was like, one, it was kind of funny because I'm thinking when I'm pushing on him on his little bike and I have a photo, he's thinking, why don't they want a photo with me? I just said to him, you know, when Papa went to the Olympics, some people want to have photos with people that went to the Olympics. And he went, but why? And I was like, okay. I was like, what do you really like? And he was like, I really like Paw Patrol. And I was like, okay. So I said, imagine if you saw like Chase and Ryder walking down the street, would you want to have a photo with them? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, so it's kind of like that. And he was like, well, but no, Papa, they're cool. And I was like, are you saying Papa's not cool? And he was like, you're not cool, Papa. And I was like, okay. I was like, well, you know, if there's ever a way to get you down to earth and ground you,
each to your own.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, all right, fine.
That's so, so sweet.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Can I ask you, after you won gold, how did that feel? Did it live up to your expectations? And do you feel a sense of relief now that you've done it? And so it kind of releases you to the rest of your life. Yeah.
It was like this complete euphoric moment that I was just so like, and you know, all the other athletes and divers are coming up, like, you know, finally, or like at last kind of thing. And it was very surreal because normally there's an audience and there's like that feeling lasts for a very long time because there's like the atmosphere that stays, you know, it was just athletes. As soon as it happened, it was like, wee, and then everyone went back on the bus or everyone went to training. Honestly, it did. I remember calling Lance and my mum like as soon as I could. And honestly, the next day when I woke up was the first day that I woke up with a real sense of peace, feeling like, you know, if I die tomorrow, I've done everything that I want to achieve. There's nothing more in this sport that I can achieve now in terms of like other events to win. And I just was like, you know what? And like you say, there was that relief, but also that feeling of like, I'm happy.
I'm so happy for you, Tom. So let's get on to your second failure. Such an interesting one. It's your fear of mistakes, which you describe as your twister. So tell us about your fear of mistakes. When do you think it started?
Gosh, there's so many of that. So I don't know if you like saw like Simone Biles during the Olympics last year where she was having problems with one of her twisting dives.
Yes.
I had a very similar thing going into London 2012. And it was then amplified by the fact that in London 2012, in the final, there was loads of flash photography. I got lost on one of my twisting dives. I asked for a redive and then got granted a redive, which was the first redive in the history of an Olympic final. So then I was up there doing this dive where I had no idea like what was going to happen next because I'd just gotten lost and my body kind of took over. And I was like, I have to go up and do this. The most scary thing that I can actually try and imagine in front of 18,000 people in the audience and then millions of people watching at home. And it was so terrifying to go and do that, that afterwards that added to the down that I was having post-Olympics. Because I was then having to figure out what I was going to do with this dive. And I just kept on trying to plod along, doing what I could and not making the correct technical changes in order to be able to make the dive better. And it just kept on getting worse and worse and worse to the point where I actually, when I moved coaches and moved to London, my coach came to me with a video from Cirque du Soleil on a Russian swing, a circus trick, essentially, where she was like, see this. This circus trick, I think, has something in it that could possibly become an Olympic dive. And I think we can work on this together. And we worked and worked and worked to get it to a point where I was the first person to complete this dive. But I used to find myself not wanting to push myself and make those changes and do those technical things because I would worry about really making mistakes and setting myself back. But I got to a point where I realized, like, if I don't try and change and don't try and push myself forwards, I'm just going to stay the same or plateau or get worse. And I had to start to get comfortable with making changes and allowing myself to make those mistakes if they didn't quite go right, but being kind to myself in that process to allow myself to do it again. Because without making those changes and therefore making sometimes mistakes, I never was going to get on the trajectory that I needed to in order to eventually win that Olympic gold.
Well, without mistakes, there is no growth.
Exactly.
Plain and simple. But do you think that that fear of mistakes that you had, did that relate to other areas of your life as well? Or was it just diving?
Everything. I think I've always had this fear of making mistakes or fearing of not being good. Because I think when you're growing up, especially growing up as a queer kid, you figure out like you don't want to disappoint in any more ways. So I've found myself really trying to be an overachiever in every single thing that I did, in order to make up for the fact that I had this thing that I felt was wrong with me at the time. Because you hear so many different things from different people and different things where like it's always like has this like bad connotation towards it. And I just felt like I had to be the person to overachieve to make up for the fact that I had this defect, if you like, is how I thought of it back then. And you know, it was once coming out and actually figuring out to actually accept who I was, that was when things started to change in that way.
And fear more generally, does that play a part in your life?
Yes. I mean, well, even when I was diving, every time I went up onto the 10 meter board, I would be terrified every single time. Every single time I'd be up there, you don't know what could happen, what little mistakes could happen. You could get too close to the board. You could hit your head. I mean, I've landed flat, bruises, coughed up blood, broken ribs, you know, you name it. It's you could do it. I've torn so many muscles. I broke my hand, you know, going into the Olympics last year, there were so many things, everything that could have gone wrong in the build up to those Olympics did. Like I got COVID and was knocked out for about 9 weeks and hospitalized for a night because it got bad.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then I tore my meniscus and had a bucket handle tear on my left knee 6 weeks before the Olympics and had to have knee surgery. So then I had knee surgery and only got back up on the diving boards 2 weeks before those Olympics. And that was where fear kind of came into it. And I was like, you know, I got to a point where I was like, there's nothing more I can do. I've done everything that I can. And that was part of it as well, of like surrendering myself to the process. Like I've manifested and manifested, and I'm going to keep visualizing myself doing what I want to do, but I can only do as much as I can. And I have to listen to my body as well. So it was a very challenging year, and but everything fell into place at the right time.
I read something that you said about fear being excitement, but without breath. Is that right? Have I quoted that right? I thought that was brilliant. Yes. I want that laminated somewhere.
It was something that Greg Louganis, who is my diving hero, he was the one who hit his head on the diving board the Olympics in Seoul and then went on to win still. Yeah, he said to me, exactly that. And I do lots of breathing techniques in order to manage anxiety and be calm when I'm competing. But he used to say like exactly that, you know, fear is just excitement without breathing. And if you are nervous going into a competition and you take the time to just like center yourself and breathe, you all of a sudden start to feel, instead of that fear and the anxiety of what can go wrong, you get excited about what could be. And I think that was something that it really took on going into those Olympics.
Incredible life advice. It strikes me listening to you, I'm reminded of an interview that I did with Matthew Saeed, who was a table tennis Olympic competitor and now is an incredible author and a sort of life guru who looks at ideas and black box thinking and all of that. And he introduced me to the notion of post-traumatic growth, where something knocks you or there's a defeat and there's a low point. But after that, there's a time when your growth is accelerated because of what you've been through. And it just strikes me talking to you, and I started off the introduction saying that you're 28, but you've got the life of a much older person, that actually so much of your wisdom comes from post-traumatic growth. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing with sport, is that you have lots of traumatic occasions, whether they be small or whether they be big, whether it's injury or whether it's psychological, whether it's defeats within the sporting competition realm, whether it's defeats on the small like scale each day in training. But then you get those little wins and then those things that you feel like you learn from and you move on to like be something that you never thought that you could be. And then that feeds into the growth on the other side of those traumatic events. So yeah, I totally think that is exactly right. And like the thing is, I think is so amazing about sport is it's such a young career that you start it at such a young age. I've had the same experiences in the 21 years that I've been diving as somebody might have in like a 20 year career that they would work in an office or something from the ages of 22 to 42, 43. So there are so many parallels with sport to the real world, if you like, whether it's goal setting, determination, setbacks, the pressure, the anxiety, the worry, the joy, the complete commiseration, or whatever it may be. There's so many things that sport can teach you going into life in general.
Fun fact about me, Tom, I can't dive. I can't dive. Oh, no. It scares the bejesus out of me. So I don't know how you do it. It's that thing of having to put your head in. Your head is basically, diving towards concrete.
But it's one of those things. It's when people like do diving and dive off a platform, they often dive like the way swimmers do with like one hand on top of each other, kind of like streamline. And the way to actually dive in for a diver is completely different to that. Your hand has to hit the water flat to protect your head on top of you. And there's this whole science behind it where you hit the water. And as soon as you hit the water, you flick your wrists apart. And when you flick your wrists apart, it creates three bubbles and it creates a vacuum that sucks you under the water, which is why divers can go in without any splash.
Wow. So, what a fact. Okay.
I know. Yeah.
Any man that I have ever had a relationship with has always insisted that they can teach me how to dive.
Oh, really?
And they have always failed. And I've never wanted to learn, I suppose, because I just had like very bad experiences at school. But I truly believe that you, Tom Daly, could teach me how to dive. What's your top tip for someone who's learning or who has never learned? What's your top tip?
Your eyes are the most important thing. And one thing I think lots of people don't realize is that your head weighs so much. For every degree that you lean your head forward or back, your body is going to move. So always lead with your eyes. And if you are diving into the pool, always look where you want to go. So for me, I would say making sure that you look where you're going. I know it sounds like obvious, but lots of people don't, or they close their eyes and they duck their head. And so, yeah, look where you're going.
Okay, thank you so much. I will report back progress.
Great.
I do like swimming. It's just the diving. Anyway, we're getting on to your third failure now, which is your knitting fails. I'm so glad we've got to the knitting.
Yay, knitting. I know. I literally, before I came on, I was like here knitting. Like I knit all the time. I take it with me everywhere. I've had so many knitting fails. And again, I do find that lots of the different things that I throw myself into teach me lots of things. From when things go wrong, I can transfer lots of the things that I've learned into other areas. To give you the story of why I started knitting and how I started knitting, in March 2020, before the pandemic, my coach said to me, "You don't sit still. You need to find something where you can rest and recover and do nothing." So then my husband said, "Well, people on film sets knit squares. Why don't you try that?" So I did. I got some needles and yarn and I was trying and I just couldn't do it. I found it really difficult. Started doing YouTube tutorials, started to get the hang of it. And then some of the other divers on the circuit, one from Australia, one from Russia, and a Chinese coach that moved to the UK, knew how to do it. And they were giving me some little tips. And then I started to like get into the groove of it. And then every project I did after that, I learned a new skill. I learned a new stitch or I learned something else. And that was when I made Made With Love by Tom Daly, the Instagram, because I didn't want to like bombard my Instagram with loads of knitting. Cause I thought, oh my God, people aren't going to want to see me knitting. Are you joking? So then once I got to a point where I was confident with knitting, I then started to design my own things. And then the Olympic knitting thing happened. The big lesson that I've drawn from knitting is one, that there are no rules, but in terms of failing, I found myself getting really frustrated when I would do something wrong or I'd spot something where I would have to unravel the whole thing. And my big thing that I learned and I read somewhere online was that when you do fail and when you do have to unravel it all, which we call frogging in the knitting world, like it's not starting from scratch. It's starting from experience because you've had all of those things happen to you. And I was like, that's something that I then was like, oh my gosh, you're right. You're not starting from scratch because you've learned so much in the process where you went wrong. You're starting from a place of experience. And I'm like, I then started to transfer that all into my diving. I was like, all of the things that I've gone wrong, each time I go into a competition, it's not starting from scratch. It's starting from experience. And being able to constantly tell myself that I've experienced so many different things. There's lots of things that I've been in this position before. I know how to deal with this. And I think that was one of the big things that I've learned from my knitting fails.
That is one of the most meaningful things I've ever heard on this podcast, and it's come about from knitting, and I'm obsessed with it. You don't start from scratch, you start from experience. That is everything that How to Fail is about.
Yeah, exactly that. Like, and it really does teach you a lot, because I think people constantly see their fails as something that like, oh, I've got to start again, like that's the worst thing. And that isn't a fail. That it's actually something that's really kind of quite empowering if you turn it into starting from a place of experience. You know, the definition of insanity really is trying the same thing over and over again without expecting a different outcome. So once you start from a place where you're going to change maybe just one thing, it can send that root of that idea or that thought into a completely different direction.
Oh my goodness, I'm obsessed. Thank you. What's the thing that you've knitted that you're proudest of?
I think I have to say the Olympic cardigan that I made, because I went into those Olympics. I was like, I want to take some yarn over there, make something that I've designed myself and something that I can look back in, say, 40 years time with my little memory box and be like, this is something that I made back in the day in 2021. And I think that for me is something that I'm really proud of. And it's kind of really the thing that started my journey of becoming and it sounds crazy to say, but becoming a knitwear designer now, and like being able to figure out a new passion later in life for me, because like I say, diving is such a young career, and to be able to have something that I'm just as passionate about as I am diving in the space of knitting is just something that I'm really, really grateful for now.
Did I make this up, or did you once tell me that you'd knitted pouches for your Olympic medals?
Yes, I did. I knit Union Jack pouches. So on one side, it's a Union Jack, and on the other side, it's a Japanese flag. And it's what I keep my Olympic medals in if I'm taking them out and about and don't want to take the big box, because usually I just used to put it in a sock. So it's a little bit more, I don't know, glamorous. Maybe not even that glamorous, but yeah, it makes it a little bit more personal.
Bespoke.
Yes.
And what are you knitting at the moment, Tom?
So I'm knitting a red jumper at the moment, a red cable jumper, because like we're coming into like sweater weather season now. So I'm always knitting something. I've made hats recently for Robbie and for Lance for the winter, making jumpers. And then it's, you know, soon I need to start making my Christmas jumpers because, you know, they're not going to make themselves.
They're not, Tommy. You need to get on it right now.
No, I know.
What's next for you? I know it's a horrible question, but over the next sort of 10 years, what future are you manifesting for yourself now? What will it involve?
In 10 years' time, I would love to think that our family is a little bit bigger. I would love to one day have like a Fashion Week show, like a London Fashion Week show. And I would love to learn more about fashion design. And I feel like that's the space I want to go into. I'm one of those people that has so many different ideas and lots of things that I want to do and want to try. And I'm of that mind of like, why not try it? Like, if you don't ask, you don't get. Try and just do whatever you can. And, you know, I'd love to be a TV host, maybe work in like film and TV. I don't know. There's lots of different things that I would give a try.
I can see it all. Are you someone who thinks about life purpose? If you had to connect all of those wonderful aspects of yourself, what do you see the connecting thread as? Why do you think you were put on this earth?
I would love to think that, and especially now with being a parent, I try to fight for lots of LGBTQ plus rights as well. And I would just love to be able to leave. And also with like knitting and it being slow fashion and more sustainable, I would love to be able to say that I did my little bit in leaving the world a better place, more accepting, more kinder, healthier place for my son when I leave it. And I hope that he thinks that he should be part of doing the same for if he ever has any kids. Because I think that's what we're all here for, is to try and leave it a better place rather than damage it and leave it in a worse place than when we came in.
Tom Daly, you've made this podcast a better place just through the sheer joy of your presence. I love talking to you so, so much. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Tom Daly, for coming on How to Fail.
I mean, thank you for having me. It's been great. It's like therapy. I love it. Thank you.
Ultimate compliment. Thank you.
Yes.
If you enjoyed this episode of How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, I would so appreciate it if you could rate, review, and subscribe. Apparently, it helps other people know that we exist.